Welcome back. So, I apologise if you come for the more astrophysical discussion now. We've covered more of the astrophysical things this morning, so this is going to be a bit more technical than you may like. I mean, obviously some people are interested in exactly what we're doing with MHD-SDH. It's kind of recognised as sort of an old problem that has had issues in the past. So I'm just going to lead you through in a brief 10 minutes on what the issues were and how we're addressing those in our current, in the way we're doing things at the moment, specifically in the context of star formation, and the implications for doing other things and what we need to be careful about. Okay, so SPH, what is it? Basically, you discretize the fluid on a bunch of moving points which follow the fluid motion, and you calculate the fluid quantities and the derivatives by expressing things as sums over nearest neighbours. So a density is, you know, from particle you get its neighbours and you sum over their masses times a weight function, which is something like a Gaussian. Now, the great thing about SVH is that that's all you need to do. Once you've defined the way you calculate the density from the neighbouring particle distribution, you can derive almost the entire method from there. It's very simple in a kind of I don't know any other numerical method where you can actually derive it from first principles. So what I mean specifically by that is that you can write down Lagrangian, which is nothing more than kinetic minus potential. Constrain it with the first law of thermodynamics, du's PdV. And the gradient of that density sum, stick it in the Lagrange equations, and what you get out is your equation of motion expressed as dvdt is sum over neighbouring particles of stuff. And this is an SVH expression for the equation of motion for a hydrodynamic gas expressed as, you know, sum over neighbouring particles times this kernel function. So you can see, like, if you're going to stick with your ideals, then there's actually a very limited scope for changing anything in SVH without breaking some of your ideals. Your ideals being that your numerical solution should reflect all the beautiful symmetries in your Lagrangian, such as conservation of everything, like the momentum, angular momentum, energy, by being invariant to rotations and translations and time and all the rest of it. Okay, so there's basically only two things you can change for hydrodynamics, and that is something about the way you calculate density, or some adding term to the Lagrangian, which is when you're adding additional physics. So there's a couple of nice examples. For example, if you want to change the way the smoothing length is done, and that comes into your density sum, and it gives you a new equation of motion with slightly different terms in it, but still respecting all those symmetries you had before, which is this sort of entropy-conserving SVH, which is just a fancy way of saying you've done the density sum a little better. So if we want to do MHD, then basically you proceed in the same way. You have a magnetic term in your Lagrangian, and you just want to perturb it and find the equations of motion. So, already to start with, it's a little bit trickier because you can't just use the density sum. You have to also constrain the evolution of the magnetic field. So you constrain, again, we'll take the perturbation of this density sum and the perturbation of the magnetic field with respect to a change in the particle positions, stick it in, perturb the Lagrangian, set the action to zero. And what you get out is, again, the equation of motion for now a magnetic gas expressed as the equation of motion is sum over neighbouring particles. So all very beautiful, all very first principles, all very wonderful. It says momentum, all the rest of it. Highly unstable. So in fact, spectacularly so. So in the regime where the magnetic pressure is dominant over gas pressure, you find the particles attract each other unstoppably and the whole simulation just clumps into various bits. So that was kind of the key problem, is that if you write down in the sensible way, which is to derive a conservative form of the SVH equations, then you find that they're unstable. So there's basically that, and there's another couple of technical issues which you have to address before you can get any scheme which can be applied to astrophysics. So basically, addressing this unstable issue is actually fairly straightforward. And it's because it relates to the fact that in MHD you have a divergence of B, and you can express the magnetic force as, well, when you write it in a, so magnetic force is J cross B, but when you write it in a stress tensor form like dSij, dXj, what you're actually expressing is J cross B plus B did B. Where this is zero analytically, but it's never true numerically. And what this term is actually the cause of the instability. So you can play various tricks, but the question is keeping momentum conservation versus keeping something which has, well, a field perpendicular, a J perpendicular to B, a force perpendicular to B, sorry. And there's a kind of long debate on it, but the basic answer is you want momentum conservation most of all because that's what gives you shocks. So the key is to try and stay close to conserving momentum as closely as possible, and that is to use a force which is exactly momentum conserving for the isotropic force and not quite for the anisotropic force, where in a sense what you're using is a more accurate derivative here as opposed to a symmetric one. So you basically use a more accurate derivative for the tension force.
And it tends to be momentum conservation rather than energy conservation which determines the shock speed. Is that obvious?
Well, what I mean by getting shocks right is whether you get states right behind the shock and whether you can do it at all. So it's just a kind of numerical question of run it, does it work or not.
But which of the conservation laws is clearly the one? Which of the two, energy or momentum?
Momentum. So then, there's a question of all this stuff is ideal. In Lagrangian, you assume no dissipation. And so you've got to have something which accounts for discontinuities or unresolved discontinuities. And the basic way we do that is to formulate this kind of general formulation of dissipation terms, which is anything you evolve on the left-hand side has a term which involves jumps in that variable. And it's sort of formulation by analogy with Riemann solvers, where it's pretty crude in the sense we just use the maximum signal velocity of all wave speeds, whereas it really should be a sum over each characteristic. And each one, so this corresponds to an artificial viscosity, this corresponds to an artificial resistivity, and this in this case is the total energy, but it gives you a contribution from each of these. And there's also a term which is an artificial thermal conductivity, which is important for that Kelvin-Helmholtz problem we talked about. But it's basically treating discontinuities properly. And again, there's this issue about allowing the smoothing length to be a variable function, so you have a really variable resolution, and bringing that back into your, and still keep your conservative form. So, and then you can do that with the Lagrangian. So that was basically the issues, apart from the other nasty one, which is this whole, which is what makes MHC difficult, is how you maintain the div B's zero constraint. And the kind of question that took a long time to work through is, do you try to do something preventative or do you just clean up the errors that you make? So I went into a lot of detail about divergence cleaning schemes and to be honest, none of them work all that well. And what we've kind of landed on is that prevention is much better. And there's kind of, one very elegant way, which also has some restrictions, is to write the magnetic field in this form, which is called Euler potentials, grad of a scalar times across the grad of another scalar, across the grad. And the nice thing about that is it corresponds to the advection of magnetic field lines by Lagrangian particles. So the evolution equation is zero, and you can't screw up zero. So it's kind of nice because you're not only constraining... You're constraining the field in the sense that normally you have three field components and one constraint, and here you've constrained it so you've only got two. So your constraint is used up. Again, there's a couple of tricks to make it work. One is you're using two first derivatives, so you want to have a pretty accurate derivative for the first to get B, which is all fair enough. And again, we need something which handles discontinuities in these variables, and so we add something which does that. Okay, there's a couple of nasty things about the Euler potentials, though. Namely that this is a little bit too restrictive. It restricts you in terms of what sort of fields you can represent. And, in practical terms, the fact that you reject these field lines means there needs to be a kind of reasonable mapping from your initial particle distribution to your final one. And, basically the end state of all Euler potential simulations will be completely mixed, random local small-scale fields. And so you basically exclude all kind of dynamo action when you write the field in this form, which is a nasty disadvantage. We had a conversation earlier, but it would be nice to get around this with a more general... So either you're back to divergence cleaning, or you're back to, or there's a possibility of using A, the vector potential, in a better way than what I had done before. Okay, but there's a restriction to where you can use oil potential, and that's kind of key. And one of the places is you don't want to use it in a turbulent dynamo. With these kind of things, we can do these kind of test problems that people would use.
You say you don't want to use it in a turbulent dynamo, which is turbulence in the
distal amine. Yeah. So you can do these kind of test problems with 1D shocks and all the different sort of discontinuities you get in MHD. And, okay, it's not as clean as your nicest PPM scheme, but you do a good job on these kind of pretty standard problems. And there's the odd little jiggle and wiggle, but you get the states right and you get these funny intermediate solutions even in this kind of problem. Even very, very strong shocks like Mach 25 shock from like a Diane Woodward paper, and you can get, you know, things like these little spikes, and the pressure's going up to, you know, 2,000 here, and the, you know, internal energy is going up by huge amounts. It's a really big, strong shock, and you get the states following the exact solution very well. And, you know, it basically shows that you're conserving things properly. And so, in terms of, you know, can you do shocks? Yep.
So Axel was beforehand already asking for energy conservation, so this is just standard way of dissipation terms?
No. Well, so it's maintaining conservation form. So it's momentum and energy conservation, which is more important, I was saying, momentum. But you have to do both.
So you're conserving total energy, or
so? One key thing that is in this pH, there's basically no difference between evolving total energy and evolving thermal. The main difference in a grid-based code is because of advection terms. In SPH, the only difference is because of your time-stepping algorithm. So actually, in practice, there's a pretty minor difference between evolving the total energy, so having an exactly energy-conserving form, and having the internal energy, like, or an entropy evolution, if you like. Yeah, and the different, well, provided you've taken account for the variable smoothing length term, so gradients of the smoothing length, which is what we do.
I have a question here. You avoid the velocity of the particles. Often what people mean by a conservative form is that they write the equations in a conservative form so that they can actually keep the errors in momentum and energy conservation, a machine error.
Yep.
But I think you can only keep it to a discretization error.
With the stability.
Oh, with your scheme, this SPH.
Why? It's exact in the sense it's even more exact.
Very exact.
In the sense that in this case, you always have a choice between either conserving total energy or conserving something like the entropy, whereas in this case you can do both to time-stepping accuracy because you get advection perfect. Yeah, So that's the whole point of using the Lagrangian scheme, which I'll show you the advantage of.
You also conserve both linear and angular momentum in grid code zones as well.
Daniel, do you have examples with gamma equal 1?
Sure.
What for those short problems?
Sure. Well, one of them was. I think that was. That's not. Yeah, that possibly is gamma of 1. No, it's not. But yes. There's no difference between gamma of 1 and gamma of not 1.
Well, the density jump is much larger.
Sure, but there's an enormous jump in that. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, if you stay conservative, you can go to any Mach number you like, and it won't break. If you break conservation, there'll always be some Mach number where it breaks. So
can I ask a basic question? When we talk about, like, the divergence free constraint, even in constraint transport or these other schemes, the subtleties are only divergence-free according to some stencil. If you were to move into a different stencil or into a cell-centered scheme, it would be very different. It wouldn't be divergence-free. So what does it mean in the context of SPH where the particles are moving to have a divergence-free field?
So I didn't really want to go into this in great detail, but there's a huge difference in the sense that constraining div B zero in your evolution has nothing to do with div B zero in your force, say. So this instability in SPH related to the presence of this term in the force has nothing to do with, you know, so if I use the oil potentials formulation, then this thing's still unstable. So you don't get around those things. So there's issues at all sorts of levels about how does div B come into your thing? Because yes, the fact that you constrain it in your evolution doesn't mean that it's...
Okay, but I think generally the question is, when you say did B equal zero, did B equal zero under what stencil?
I think a lot of the problems with SPH and did B equal zero comes from the fact, essentially, that with SPH the stencil is continually changing, whereas on the grid it isn't. And I think a lot of that is actually the problem with the did SPH.
I'll show you what I really mean in a second. I mean, what you really mean is, do you get test problems right or not?
Right.
You know,
ultimately, you want the problem to be stable.
Right, but one of the tests is, when I look at the final magnetic field output, does it have zero divergence?
Okay, but that's hard to measure, because, again, you measure it with all sorts of different stencils.
Right.
And,
right. Even with constrained transport, if you're moving to a different stencil, it would be...
Right, I'm just curious, under... what are you guaranteeing? Derivative are you guaranteeing?
What I really mean is that my stars don't explode. So, I mean, again, you can do these more complicated problems and you do them very well with SPH in the same sense that they're very comparable to, really good PPM schemes, and you get the structures right in this kind of 2D problem. I haven't paid much attention to the symmetry in initial conditions here, so you lose a bit of symmetry in this reconnection phase. But
could you describe what we're seeing?
Sorry. This is kind of the... So this is the initial geometry of the magnetic field. It's a periodic box, and you've got a big vortex in velocity, and it's, which is periodic again. So you get basically four shocks which cross the box, bang into each other, and make a kind of complicated mess by the end. But it's just something that people have been using for years and years and years to benchmark MHD codes. And you look at any MHD paper and you'll find this problem.
Do the blocks that you generate, are they physical?
No, they're entirely physical in the sense no one usually shows the problem past the 0.5. Jim Stone's got a nice one on his webpage, say if you wanted to have a comparison. I mean, I'd like to try and do a bit better of a job of trying to maintain the symmetry, which is just a consequence of the fact that I haven't sort of reflected the particle distribution across the axes. Okay, again, some other problems you find in... I mean, my criterion is that SPH shouldn't be a poor man's version of MHD. We want to have an MHD that is really benchmarked against the same things as uses to benchmark grid-based MHD codes. Here's a sort of spinning dense disk in a sort of ambient magnetic field, so this is compression of the magnetic field along the axis. You can see it's just an expanded sort of rotating type blast wave. One of the problems, I'm going to basically stop, but to me the advantage of a Lagrangian scheme is that you get advection right from the word go. So, I mean, this is one of the problems that... Jim Stone found was one of the most distinguishing things in benchmarking Athena, is just take a loop current and a vector across the box. And so this is the results from various different schemes that they tried after two crossings. So you can see it's descended into sort of all sorts of funny shapes. And with their particular way of doing things, they get something which is diffused only a little bit after two crossing times. So this is the same problem done with SPH. So the top movie is just showing the first 10 crossings, and the bottom movie, which you can't even tell is a movie, is showing you, 1,000 crossings of this thing. It could just run forever because it doesn't change. And so the point is, the whole point of doing... the reason why SPH should give you an advantage is because you do advection perfectly, and this is something that's very hard for a grid-based scheme. So, the only hope with all this mess that you have to deal with is that you get something good, which is advection. Yeah.
So, if it's just the transport of the entire box, so just linear transverse, why do you get any error in the center? Why is there additional...
In a grid-based code, you can never, ever do away with...
Again, I thought this was yours.
This is a grid-based code.
This was also grid-based. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... I mean, the point is, in a grid-based code, by moving things, you get diffusion, which you can't turn off. So in SPH, any diffusion you have, you have always added. So this is not quite fair in the sense that, in reality, to get shocks, you always add diffusion. So you do have resistivity there. But the key is that if you can design a good switch, then you can get back to this case. Because you can actually run it with it off. You can run it with all dissipation off, as in not there. Whereas... Whereas you can't ever turn implicit numerical diffusion off. So, I mean, it's not further in practice. Actually, SVH is usually more diffusive because, well, the shock dissipation tests are pretty crude. But it gives me hope that, in the sense that what's wrong in SVH can be improved, whereas it's hard to get around these issues that you have just from fundamental kind of understandings. So, I mean, that's really all I wanted to say. I mean, I hope it's sort of reasonably convincing that we're not just got a sort of toy scheme that's, that we're claiming is going to do the whole world's problems without having benchmarked it. And it's only really last year, I mean, I started working on this in 2001, 2002 on my PhD, and it's only really last year that we've started applying to star formation problems in a meaningful way. I think I'll stop there. I mean, I could show you. Oh, okay, so one thing I was going to say, my criteria for div B of zero is really that if you try and form a star and you drag down a magnetic field with it, like, does it do that? And if you try and if you use the Euler potentials formulation to constrain the evolution of the magnetic field, then it sort of behaves itself. So it's kind of these, and what you're doing is dragging down the field. And if you get the gradients wrong, then or unresolved gradients in the field, then it just explodes. I mean, so we've been applying to things such as the effect on binary formation, where you have a Z field through the box and you try and form a binary star, increasing the magnetic field strength, and you find that the magnetic fields drive it to form a single star by the suppression of fragmentation. And again, the difference between running with a field perpendicular to that's aligned with the rotation axis, which is this case, which is that case, versus running with a field which is in the plane of the rotation axis. And you can see the difference here between, again, tension and pressure, which is sort of what we discussed a bit this morning, that if there's a huge difference in the way you've aligned the field in terms of what you get out, and you can see the difference there between with the X field, you really stretch things out along these field lines, and with the Z field, you say much more. Well, you don't. So, I mean, yeah. Here's just another thing I didn't show you this morning, but in the mass to flux ratio 3 case of this collapse, and you can see the sort of streaming motions parallel to the field lines here, and again this sort of big void through the middle. But this is an interesting one because we hadn't gone down this far in mass to flux ratio until Chris suggested it at the last conference, and you do see some interesting things. I don't know if I can just take that back to the start. And especially this sort of streaming stuff, you only see at these very low mass to flux ratios. And it is suggestive of, that stuff you see in Taurus, where you get that sort of effect. And, it's a little bit early to say whether that's really true or not. But and so at the moment with these simulations, we don't really trust the star formation that much, apart from mainly because we're running at the resolution of the hydrodynamic calculations, which has nothing to do with resolving MHC properly. So what we're really saying is stuff about the large scales. And what we're seeing on the star formation is just the difference in accreting onto the difference in holding up the large scales of the cloud. So in this paper's submitted and should be out.
Well, so you're saying that you require higher resolution for MHD than PhD?
Well, so the issue is doing away with numerical dissipation. So it's resolving away the numerical dissipation, really to the point where you can put in physical dissipation.
You mean that your Prandtl number is always much less than 1 in some sense?
Yes. Well, the Prandtl number is always 1, almost by definition, the Prandtl number. I mean, the dissipation always makes, like artificial viscosity basically always makes sure that the Reynolds number is 1 at the grid scale. So, almost exactly. So, the Reynolds number is always 1 at the particle scale. And so it's the same thing with the magnetic Reynolds number.
So why do you require higher resolution with magnetic fields?
Well, so all of the sort of general dissipation terms, all they are is a formulation of second derivatives in SPH. So viscosity is new. Well, it's a it's slightly more complex. It's a combination of grad div V and other stuff. But basically, if you just think of it as the bulk term, it's a new del squared V, where this new is exactly, proportional to, where the proportionality factor is about 1/8. Dimensionless number that you choose, single velocity, which is the parameter you have out the front, and particle spacing. So your dissipation terms scale like spacing of particles. Sorry, this is more appropriate to say H here. It's spacing of particles within your smoothing kernel. So your dissipation terms are always kind of first order, and they go like single velocity H. So in the magnetic case, you've got an eta, which is like alpha, which you choose is about 1, say, single velocity H. So that's what dissipation you have, and that's the thing you have to do away with to, you know, to be sure that your numerical dissipation is lower than your... With the caveat that you can play... So you play games with switches to get this alpha down to 0 away from shocks and stuff. Does that make sense? That's our kind of resolving criteria is beating down dissipation.
But why from there I should see that you require higher resolution?
I mean, the bottom line there is when you have MHD gradients, you get strong forces, okay? I mean, by definition, with MHD you get, with hydrodynamics it's fine if you follow down to the Bondi radius, basically, because then anything that goes inside that is never going to come out again. It's not true with magnetic fields, okay? So, by definition, you have jets. So, ideally, you want to resolve all the way down to the star and resolve the jet. Whereas, from a gravitational hydrodynamics point of view, all you want to do is resolve the Bondi radius and you're fine.
You have discontinuities, you have shocks, you have shear.
It all just gets swallowed by the gravity. Nothing ever comes out again. What? But in MHD, it can come out.
No. I mean, supersonic turbulence, I can even turn off gravity, then nothing gets swallowed. And even if so gravity, you have shocks that are not swallowed by gravity.
It's not so much gravity, but probably as the presence of high density medium. On this pH, if you follow
the medium,
you have automatically have resolution.
Yeah, on one side, not the other, so I'm not so sure it's true.
Yeah,
but the discussion of jets does bring up an interesting question, which is that can you get a jet if you can't follow helicity?
No. I suspect is the answer. But, I mean, that's one of the reasons. So Robbie and I have started a benchmarking test to do a common problem where, we're not sure if the issue is, you know, just the fact you have to resolve low-density things with strong density contracts, or if there's an issue with the helicity stuff. And I suspect it's a bit of both. But that's one of the things to check. I mean, and that's why we started doing this comparison thing.
Then, but isn't it different? Isn't it that the MHD is more unstable than EHD, so you need higher viscosity, higher resistivity, that's why you need higher resolution. It's not because it's EHD versus MHD.
Well, it's due to the fact that when you've diffused a gradient in the magnetic field, it's gone forever. So if you've started out with quite a bent field to start with, and you've made it flat, then you're never going to get back the bentness, if you like. So you've got to do away with your diffusion all the way down, if you like, because you don't... It's not like a gradient in... I mean, perhaps the same is true with some things like angular momentum, right? I mean, we don't diffuse angular momentum in SVH, so that's not an issue, but, you know, once you've lost angular momentum, you never get it back. It's the same thing with, you know, once you've diffused a magnetic field, you don't get it back again.
But with a shock, you do. If you smooth out a shock, it gets sharp again
because it steepens.
It starts flowing in again.
No, with the shock, nonetheless, I think we have diffusion and density or something like that, you're not going to be able to shut the magnetic.
Well, we don't have diffusion and density. So
it's more similar to convex conductivity. If you smooth the convex conductivity.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like thermal conductivity. Once you've diffused gradient in, exactly. So I mean, magnetic diffusion is like that because once it's gone, it's gone.
I want to ask a question about, because you did the vortex. I would have thought that would involve helicity. Maybe.
So there's a distinction here between 2D and 3D.
Okay.
So the order potentials are exactly the same as the vector potential in 2D. And I mean, in 2D, you have all the same problems as. To me, that's the nice example is, you know, the MRI in 2D. You can't have a dynamo in 2D for the same reason. That you restrict your helicities and you can't.
Vorticity in 2D
is 3D. Well, sure, but there's, I mean, Cowling's anti-dynamo theorem or whatever is about the fact that you can't have.
No, I'm just saying that the distinction between 2D and 3D is one part of vorticity.
electricity.
I was talking about magnetic electricity.
Well, electricity. You have a velocity. You need three dimensions. Electricity.
Sure.
Two dimensions.
I mean, it's a simpler, you know, the simpler way is just thinking that, you know, you have something which the evolution of which is zero. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can't ever make stuff if you don't have a, you know, a term which is enables you to make it. You know, so it's.
Fine. I just wondering if you had a simple test problem that's simpler than actually trying to get, you know, a protozoan back to work, where you would see the effect of the
shock. Well, it needs to be 3D then. That's the key.
Right, exactly. So,
it's kind of picture the way you're in your boiler potentials in your 3D problem. What you would be actually missing is, so you've got these complicated amount of shocks occurring, et cetera, probably ways of generating terms that aren't, you can't really capture boiler potentials.
I'm just
wondering what kind of terms those are might be, other than things involving electricity. But do you have a picture of what you're missing?
Yeah, I mean, so maybe a nice case is take a galaxy where you're trying to rotate, you know, where you're trying to wind up a field by rotation. So you, with the oil potential, so you take a ring of particles and you move them all the way around back to where they came from, then you come back to where you started with, yeah, because nothing's changed about the gradients and the potentials. So what you miss is you don't remember anything about winding, because you know you've lost the mapping from the initial to the final particle distribution. So it's kind of.
Well, so then you would be missing out on a lot of magnetic breaking strength.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm worried about.
You wouldn't be getting, as Ruby and I found, these launching torsion waves as your disk collapses. That was my next question.
Yeah, I mean, we do find that. But again, it's how long, you know, it's how long before you lose the connection with, you know, with your initial, before you lose the, you know, the resolution of the wind-up, if you like.
So that would probably limit you strongly in the jet problem, too.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, the way around this, we had a conversation yesterday about going back to the vector potential. Because the only reason for oil potential is not because it's fundamental, just because it solves a DFB problem without having to worry about it. But maybe the vector potential can be used in that way. I mean, the way I was trying to do the vector potential was not the best way, and it didn't work very well. But Axel suggested maybe there's other ways which do work.
What about just DFB cleaning? I mean, Flashcode uses that reasonably well, I think.
Well,
always things can be improved, but have you done experiments, Steve?
Sure, so I had a very tortuous paper looking at all kinds of DFB cleaning. And
what was your conclusion?
So, I mean, one of the things in SPH is just that as soon as you calculate a DFB, which you need to clean it up, you smooth over a lot of small-scale stuff. You know, so, and wherever you always generate error at the grid scale, so it's always small-scale stuff you're trying to clean. But if you're trying to clean it by first smoothing over it, then, you know, so the general thing we found was that, yes, all these schemes work really well when you have a well-resolved gradient, but when you have something which is, you know, small-scale and, you know, been made in the course of the simulation by your truncation error, then it doesn't work so well. You know, so, you know, we try this hyperbolic cleaning stuff, which actually has other issues too. It never seems to work very well. And I mean, one of the issues is also that you kind of need a global cleanup of the field. And in star formation, that's a really big issue because, you know, I mean, so solving Poisson equation to clean up div B is the fact that, you know, you've got, it's how often you need to do it. Because you've got this star doing complicated things, and the rest of it, you're basically not moving. So you're on, you know, very short individual time steps, moving 5 particles and keeping the rest still. And if every 10 time steps you have to project over the whole domain, you know, to get rid of your divergence, then it's just not feasible.
Well, that's the sort of situation that, you know, AMR faces, for example, in that when we want to do our radiation solve, you know, all the action's on the small scale, but we have a non-local, we have some non-local operation that couples everything, but, I mean, that's the point of having a multi-grid method, a multi-level multi-grid method. So you do your updates just on the fine stuff using the core stuff as a constraint, and then the price you pay for that is that you have to do a non-local synchronization operation at the end, which is sort of painful, but you only have to do it, you know, once every coarse time step as opposed to once every fine time step.
And it depends on how much you're screwing up the divergence in the short time steps. Okay. Because if you're screwing it up fairly regularly on the short time steps, then you have to do cleaning pretty regularly.
But if you did a cleaning, you have to solve for some equation, which is not easy.
Well, again, it's a similar issue. You have to actually evaluate div B.
Yeah, but and then you have to invert the Poisson.
Yeah, I mean, okay. And we did that in, you know, by direct summation, or the equivalent is using the tree. But again, solving the entire tree is a big mess if you do it every 5 time steps. So a lot of these things kind of work well, but star formation makes everything so much more complicated because of the range of timescales and length scales.
But I guess I don't understand why it is analogous to, like, gravity. I mean, you need to know the gravity. You need to know about gravity every time you do a fine update, but you probably only, you know, reevaluate the parts of the tree that involve the, you know, the particles that are moving and maybe a few more. You don't re-sum the entire tree for gravity. So why do you need to for div B?
Because gravity doesn't explode things. Magnetic fields are horrible.
Okay then.
You get weird gradients, you get.
I think there's nothing wrong with advecting the vector potential. I mean, SUS is essentially the same formulation with the transport, with the constraint transport in the same grid. So the question is most probably what kind of, you know, gauge something you, I mean, you have to consider.
Well, the other potential fixes the gauge because you've got no freedom left. The problem is that
your degrees of freedom already.
The problem is it restricts it too much. You go a little bit too far.
Why not to use the full vector potential instead of the components alpha and beta?
Well, so the other potentials don't correspond to the full vector.
Yes, that's what I mean. Well, it would make a big problem once you have devices involving using potentials like higher order derivatives or so, why not to go and use a full vector potential instead?
Well, we had this discussion yesterday. And, I mean, the reason was I tried it and, well, the thing I tried, which I didn't realize you could do it another way, was, you know, I mean, in a good base code, DADT is B cross B, which, you know, you evaluate B anyway, so there's no real derivatives involved in that. And, you know, in SVH you have to add B dot grad A. So you're putting advection back in, if you like, in a horrible way. But as Axel said yesterday, you can rearrange this stuff so that actually it's an A dot grad V, and you don't do any of this stuff. So which is similar to, well, it's not quite an A dot grad V, it's an A V with a grad, something like that, J. So you can do it that way around, which maybe will work, but I haven't tried. Yeah, that's all. Well, except I think I'll hand back to Axel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wanted to kind of come back to these questions a bit, which we didn't talk about this morning, but maybe we'll see.
You can leave your computer there and then we can get back to that.
So let me actually talk about this, maybe just stop the vector potential. Let me go to 2 pages ahead, because that's where you just stopped. So you said you can reformulate it differently, and I just wrote equations in the form that I suggested, and that we and other people have been using before. I think I found this actually in a book by either Roberts, 67, I think I found it. And so I was lucky that I... there was one moment when I needed this desperately, and that was when we were doing shearing sheet approximation. So if you do a shearing sheet, you have to have a Lagrangian derivative with respect to the shear. Otherwise it wouldn't work. And so obviously in U cross B there is no such a Lagrangian derivative term. And that was why it didn't work. And then I saw by chance this book by Roberts in the HAO library. And the same Sunday I read it, I coded this up and it was working perfectly. So here's how it works. So you have this U cross B term. You have diffusion, which I keep as a dot, dot, dot in later on, but it should be there. And you have, in principle, a gradient of a gauge potential, of an electrostatic potential. Now, B is just the curl of A, of course. And this you can express in terms of an epsilon times another epsilon. This gives you delta delta minus delta delta. Outside is always a uj term, so you have a uj term. And the first term is immediately an advection term. The comma denotes the derivatives, partial derivative. And then you have, of course, the same thing with uj, but I and j being interchanged. So in principle, you could stop here, because once you move this then to the left-hand side, this together with that gives you your Lagrangian derivative, and there you are. But that was not everything. For the Shearing-Sheet approximation, there was one more problem, and the problem is that the velocity itself is non-periodic. In a Shearing-Sheet, you want to have all quantities being periodic with respect to the x-direction. And of course, velocity is not, because it's shearing. It's minus something on the left-hand side, it's plus something on the right-hand side. So that would not work yet. So you have to go one more step. And the step is to put the remaining term, which is this one, underneath a total derivative. So you have uj and aj, and you differentiate outside everything, like here. It keeps the same plus sign. And of course, you have the other term. Now you differentiate uj. And a remains undifferentiated. Okay, so now what you're left with is something where a always was periodic. And the velocity, it was not periodic, but you differentiated once. And if the shear is linear, a linear function becomes a 1. And the function 1 is periodic. And so now we are in business with this term. Except that there's still this term hanging around. But I have also written down this one, so you can actually now choose a gauge such that phi is equal to u dot b, u dot a. And that's a possible gauge. And there you are. So all this mess you had in the beginning reduces just to this. And there shouldn't be a problem with SPH at all. Any comments so far?
Sounds great to me.
But a gauge which is velocity dependent is sounds kind of strange to me.
So this then, just to understand it, so you keep it fixed over the entire simulation? So this is quitted perfectly here?
That's the perfect?
Yes, of course. Yes. So, so the gauge would then be that this phi is always equal to that. And you don't never ever need phi. If you ever wanted phi, you can still do this. And that brings me actually back to another page here, yes, which is this one, which we have done for fun in recent years, or in recent months perhaps sometimes. It highlights, so people are often not too familiar with the vector potential. And it is actually amazing that in the case where you have the MHD equation, the isothermal limit, there's a striking analogy, not between u and v, but between u and a. So there's a few differences as well. Here's a partial differentiation, and here's now a total again. You can, of course, in principle, get rid of this, but then at the expense of getting rid of this. This is a u cross b here, our familiar term. Whereas in the hybrid equation, you have a u cross omega. So if you have a dynamo here for the velocity, for the magnetic field, you could, in principle, have a dynamo, you don't see it here yet, for the magnetic field or the vorticity as well, in principle. Whether it works, we don't know yet. The answer perhaps seems to be no. You have a dissipation term in both cases. I didn't quite say what Q is, but you should think of Q basically as being the curl of the vorticity. But in order for this term to be correct, there's a few, two other small terms. And then you have, of course, a gradient of the pressure. But you can write this, if you write this equation in terms of U, you can write this as an enthalpy, a negative enthalpy, plus T times grad S. And if you have an isothermal gas or a polytropic gas, this other term vanishes. And so you're just left with a gradient term, which in the isothermal case really just corresponds to the sound speed squared times the logarithmic density. So to be precise, one could call it, or should call it, pseudo-enthalpy. And if you now restore your electrostatic potential, you realize that electrostatic potential is something like a pressure. in the uncurled induction equation. And then, of course, you can, in principle, begin to solve also an evolution equation for this. So in the electrostatic input for the enthalpy, which is really the logarithmic density, we have the familiar equation that the derivative, which I've written actually here, that's the formula that we're normally using. The logarithmic derivative of the density is equal to the negative divergence of the velocity. But if you multiply both sides with the sound speed squared, you have the enthalpy, or the pseudo-enthalpy, and you have here your sound speed times the divergence of u. And you could, in principle, choose a similar gauge for the vector potential, which would be this one. And so what you then have is waves. You restore waves in the electrostatic potential, which you normally don't want. But if you choose for the sound speed, for this speed here, not the speed of light, which would then be the Lorentz gauge, but some other velocity, which you are free to do, you have simply other waves in your gauge potential. And the advantage of this is it allows you to actually keep track of this. And the other advantage is you're closer to a Coulomb gauge than you would be otherwise. And that has certain, in the sense that you're trying to mimicking that the divergence of A is very small, the same way as you're, if you have a weakly compressible situation, you're mimicking that the divergence of U keeps small. This is funny. So that is interesting that there's such a striking analogy between the two. But now about one particularly striking advantage of the vector potential that Orke brought up at one point, and I can demonstrate this here explicitly. In the formulation in terms of the magnetic field, you have to take the first derivative twice, first in the momentum equation, and then again in the induction equation. You have the curl of U cross B. And so if you have Alvin waves, you have a constant magnetic field, and you have to differentiate the velocity field here, and here you differentiate the departure from the imposed magnetic field in the perpendicular direction. So first derivative is twice. In the A formulation, you have the current. In, of course you have the current, but the current is expressed now in terms of the vector potential directly, and so that involves a second derivative once. But there's no derivative in the induction equation. So if you are doing a centered mesh, which is what we are doing with the pencil code, it is certainly better to do a second derivative once than a first derivative twice. Just think.
But
yeah.
The issue with second derivative once is that you can't express it as the gradient of a symmetric stress tensor. And therefore you can't get momentum conservation.
And there's another issue, because my recollection is that in terms of grid-based schemes, if one has, for instance, a shock, then taking second derivatives may not be a very good thing to do. So when the vector potential, I think, was looked at some time ago, and that was partially the reason why people moved into these other types of
methods. Yeah. I should say that whatever we do, we never do a second order accuracy in our derivatives. We always do a sixth order. And that changes things.
But if there's a discontinuity, I mean, that's, you know, yeah, you're getting first order no matter how many terms you have.
If you are resolving your, so you can do the test with a Tunge shock, for example, which is what we've done. The point is you have to resolve the shock with a few mesh points barely, and you are doing your calculated derivative more accurately, much more accurately, with a bare number of points within the shock, if you are sixth order compared to second order. And so you're gaining in accuracy. You're certainly not going back. The point is simply we are resolving the shock with a few mesh points, which means three mesh points in the shock, in the Tunge shock. And you're getting a very good derivative. So the idea is simply to calculate all the terms as accurately as you can possibly do. You're not solving the code, you're not solving the equations to machine accuracy, but you're solving them to the discretization error accurate.
What about the problem that Daniel did, which had this very strong isothermal shock? Mm-hmm. Could you really do this?
There are limitations to that. I mean, if you do a shock jump of 1,000, we begin to see errors which are, and then of course, after that it becomes even worse. 100, pressure jump of 100 is quite easy. 1,000 is also possible, but it's no longer Perfect. And so I think there are limitations, as you were also saying, at large shock strengths, isn't it? Do you have another comment on that? So I think there's a fair point. There's very strong shocks. Most of our applications, I should also say, are primarily in the subsonic case. That's where most of our work is being confined to. And then these advantages have great advantages, of course, these methods. But we can also do, of course, as we have done in the test, Mach 10 calculations. So let me now show you the difference here in a simple advection test. So we have here the A formulation, and we have initial condition of a bump in the vector potential, and then that spreads out in two waves which jump to the sides. The mesh is periodic, and so they travel through and meet again in the middle. So this looks fairly straightforward, and in the B formulation, you begin to see a little bit of a wiggle here already. Let me play this one then again. And so the same vigors that you see here, you don't really see here. And the difference becomes even more striking if you go down from 128 mesh points to 64 mesh points. So now you begin to see a few vigors in the vector potential here too, or in the magnetic field rather, the field which is shown. But in this case here, of course, it's clearly much worse. So it is certainly easier to get away with these vigors, or don't create too many vigors, by having the A formulation. And that is the reason is simply that you have an infinitely large discretization error, this came in the background here. If you calculated the derivatives, you of course have in fact only an effective wave number that you can calculate. And if you do the first derivative at the Nyquist frequency, the effective wave number drops down to zero. And that is because if you take a derivative between two points which are symmetric, the derivative is always zero. Is there no signal? So if you have a Nyquist signal like so, you take a derivative at this point. You take this point minus that point gives you already zero, and taking another derivative of zero gives you still zero. But taking the second derivative immediately gives you four divided by delta x squared in second order and pi squared at higher order divided by delta x. So two more things here. One is it's related to the issue of whether you can have a dynamo for vorticity or not. So what we have done is we have looked at the evolution in a potential flow. And so potential means that the forcing is really just a gradient of a random function, of a Gaussian, for example, of lots of Gaussians. And so you're producing something which looks like localized bumps. They spread out. All this is subsonic here. And so after some time, of course, you generate a mess. As far as the power spectrum is concerned, you get something which is close to the k to the minus 2 power spectrum here. And you clearly see the effective forcing scale, which has to do with the radius of the individual blobs. So that corresponds to the forcing scale here in the simulation. The question is, what happens to the magnetic field, first of all? The magnetic field is, of course, in some sense, analogous thing to the vorticity. Can we have magnetic field generation in the absence of vorticity? To clarify one point here, you said earlier that that you cannot do dynamos because you cannot do helicity. Dynamos don't necessarily require helicity. It's only the large scale dynamos of the alpha squared or alpha dynamo type that does require helicity. Small scale dynamos don't require helicity. But all the dynamos that I'm aware of require at least vorticity. There's some work especially in the Russian literature of the 70s, which says you can have dynamos with vorticity, and numerically, there's no verification of this so far. And this is how it works at a 512 cube simulation. If you have a flow which is, at least in this case, it's not even purely potential, there's in principle at least small deviations from this because of the viscosity operator, it's nevertheless very nearly potential flow. You have simply just a decay of the energy at large scales, at large wave numbers, so it just decays here this time. You have no evolution at all, even over quite large length scales at the large wave numbers, which means at the large scales, which means the small wave numbers. So you're basically just decaying and losing energy. So there's no gain at all, no dynamo action at all in the absence of vorticity. But here's the analogy between the B evolution equation, which has this U cross B, and here the vorticity equation, which has U cross omega. Well known. And both have a dissipation term. And in the vorticity equation, there are a few more terms on the right-hand side, not a whole lot of additional terms. This is a term that comes in from the viscosity operator. So the dissipation, of course, is normally a del squared of U, and there is one more term, which is a divergence of the it's a gradient of the divergence of U. But then, if the density is not constant, there is also a term which is equal to the curl of the strain tensor dotted into the logarithmic density derivative. You can never get rid of this. And it's this only term which can produce vorticity in a potential, in a barotropic flow, which means a flow where the equation of state is, where P is just a function of rho, there's no temperature involved or entropy. So then there's only one single term which can potentially produce vorticity, except that, of course, this in principle can also produce vorticity. Because if this was absent, it would be analogous to the magnetic field equation. And if you do have dynamo action, which I showed just on the previous page, then this term could in principle produce, through the nonlinear interaction with itself, could in principle produce vorticity, and it never does, according to our experience. There's no theoretical reason why it shouldn't, but numerically speaking, it never has happened. And so we have done the calculations at up to 512 cube to see whether this term can produce any RMS vorticity normalized in sensible units to the RMS velocity and the wave number of the peak. And all these numbers are small, 10 to the minus 3. These are relative ratios. They should be of order unity, of course. They are small, and they would be of order unity in vortical turbulence, but they are really small and seem to converge in some cases, or seem to not at least blow up as a function of Reynolds number. So that was one issue, which I think is really important. So I think it's important to check other codes, whether other codes, if you do a potential equation of state, a barotropic equation of state, whether your code produces artificial vorticity or not. And the way to check that is by doing a forcing function, which is potential. So you could then see whether you all of a sudden produce massive amounts of vorticity, which could happen if your dissipation operator is out of control. Or it would not happen if you believe at least that your dissipation operator is the correct one and resolve to discretization errors.
So that could happen also for something that is close to a term, even very close to.
Yes, you could, of course, measure explicitly how big a baroclinic term you have, which is grad T grad cross grad S. You can measure how big that is. It may not actually be very big, and so maybe you could test that too. But why is it a difficulty normally to do, for example, isothermal flows?
No, but there are cases where one cheats, doesn't have an isothermal solver, but... Mm-hmm. You are almost as a thermal.
Yeah, okay.
But you're not really as a thermal.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that could be one of these risky situations.
I see.
I think Wolfram Schmidt did experiments with purely compressional driving with PPM using gamma close to 1, not exactly 1. And he says that there is no vorticity showing up. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think it is stable.
That's interesting. Who says this?
Wolfram Schmidt.
Okay. Yes, very good. Yeah. Okay, one more issue then, about the shock viscosity. So, okay, and we also subsequently used a method of course, a Neumann viscosity, which is a viscosity which begins to become big within the shock, where you have strong compression. So the question is, how much of the rest of MHT is being screwed up by this? As a backup, background information, I should simply say that if you do, for example, a thing like hyperviscosity, and you are investigating a helical dynamo, you are screwing up completely. Or you're not screwing up in some sense, but you're actually getting a result which is very different in a way that you can actually predict. You will overemphasize with hyperviscosity the generation of the large-scale magnetic field. So, for example, in many of the geodynamo simulations, hyperviscosity was used. And because of this potential problem, I suggest these simulations should be checked again, because they could produce a predictable enhancement, artificial enhancement of the large-scale magnetic field. But that's not the issue of this thing here. It just says it could be very important to look at the potential effects of subgrid scale modeling. And hyperviscosity is not really a subgrid scale model, but it's a commonly used cheat, of course. So here's what we tested. We tested a transonic turbulence. So we increased the Mach number. In this case, it goes up to only 2.5. And we compare both direct simulations, which means a constant viscosity, and we use shock viscosities. Here with two different shock parameters. 0.8 is a small and marginally okay value, and 3 is certainly overdoing it. And so what we've looked at is the critical the critical magnetic Reynolds number for small-scale dynamo action, which is one of the common issues you want to address, at Prandtl number unity. And so this value is on the order here, it's actually only 25. I don't know why it's not 35, but in this case it looks like more like 25. Maybe there's an error also, an error bar here. So at least that's approximately the value that we find here. And we then increase the Mach number, and we find this value increases. But then it does not increase much more anymore. The same we find, so that's a simulation with, that's actually a direct simulation, but it is at a Prandtl number, okay, of not of unity, that's why it's on 35, but of 5. Now here we have a simulation with Prandtl number unity, and then you are at 35 here, as I said. And again, you find a very similar behavior. So you find something which you could call a bimodal behavior, where you have a certain critical magnetic Reynolds number in the subsonic regime, and then you have another value which is independent of the Mach number in the supersonic regime. And you find the same results both for a constant viscosity, which is a solid line where you can only go to just about unity in this case, it's 5 curve cube, and the shock viscosity. These two other curves are very close to the other one. So we find this is a good result, a positive result. It says shock viscosity does at least not screw up the hydrodynamics. One way of interpreting such a result is, of course, to say that the velocity is really composed of a potential part plus the solenoidal part, whose divergence is free. And we know from simulations that Orker and Paolo did, and also, of course, from, I think, Woodward and company also had that there's a certain ratio between these two velocity components that does not diverge, that stays fixed in the supersonic case. And so, with this in mind, one can say that the Reynolds number, the appropriate Reynolds number, with which you should define the critical onset condition, should just rely on the solenoidal part of the velocity. And it doesn't care about this. So as you drive the turbulence more supersonic, you just get an additional contribution from this, which increases your Reynolds number, but it's really this part that it cares about. Yes, and here's the pictures and And this is basically all I wanted to say here. I have a few more pictures which back up some of the things I said earlier in the morning. This was this 1,000 cube simulation here of 2003, where we see the power law being very close to k to the minus 1.5, which is what Bolderev mentioned a week ago or so. We see magnetic field being in slight super-equipartition relative to the velocity spectrum, which is in blue here, by a factor which could be close to, which is between 4 and 5 approximately.
That's a unity Prandtl-Lamar case.
That's a unity Prandtl-Lamar case, yes, and it's a direct simulation. It is then strange to see that these two are not the same. You would, of course, expect that the two should be the same, although the reasons for that are not terribly strong. You would think of having Alvenic turbulence at some point. So maybe at larger wave numbers, if you could resolve those, they would come closer together. You cannot reach this at this point yet, but what we can do is a subgrid scale model. And so one of the subgrid scale models that we have used is Smogorinsky viscosity. And one thing you see then is the two spectra show a tendency of getting closer together. So maybe that could be what will happen in the future, and then really things should be together.
Mm-hmm. Could one, just a sort of definition by me, one could say that Alvenic turbulence doesn't necessarily imply that they're together, in the sense that if you have oppositely large poles or something, right, then you have field, I think you talked about this before, you have velocity that mm-hmm. flows along the field lines, mm-hmm. still Alvenic turbulence, but you get a lot of magnetic power on small scales that you wouldn't see in the velocity, even though
yes.
the turbulence is actually Alvenic.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I said it. There's no strong reason really to think that they should be the same. Yeah. On the other hand, they may indeed still be the same. One reason is this. The other reason is a closure model, whatever you take from that, by Müller and Grappin in 2005, which suggests something which looks very close to that. And in our 2006 paper on physical fluids, we made a comparison to that, and the simulations seem to support this. So this model would suggest, indeed, that the residual, the energy difference between those two can be finite at small rate numbers, but it would go to zero because it scales with a different power.
What's the ratio between how much to little and compressional and cortical components you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are really only arguments, as we talked about, in terms of the degrees of freedom. You have more degrees of freedom in the for the vertical velocity, for the vertical part, than for the compression. That's also an argument I think that you made, and other people made. Yes, one thing which I didn't actually say yet is when I got into this business of doing direct simulations, I was very scared by the result that Christian Müller presented in their 2000 paper. So they had a direct simulation. This was a decaying turbulence in both cases. These power spectra are compensated by k to the 5/3. So that is a direct simulation, normal diffusivity. And what they find is that they find perfectly a k to the minus 5/3 power spectrum. So it's flat when it's compensated. But if they use a hyperviscosity, they get not only just the dissipation being suffering initial bump, but also the inertial range is completely changed. And so in fact, everything is, both the dissipation and the inertial range, are being very drastically affected by this. And so that was very scary, if that is really true. Whether it's true or not, I'll come to this in a moment. Let me just... Yes, indeed. And so what we've done then was a range of different simulations, and by now we can compare against the 4096 benchmark, of course, of Kaneda. So the black line is the Kaneda incompressible turbulence simulation, the very extended polar spectrum. One of the things you see, it's again compensated by k to the plus 5/3, one of the things you see is a bump in the spectrum, and that is referred to as a bottleneck. So in the year 2003, it was still not really very clear whether it's, and it's even now not completely accepted yet, whether it's really a physical effect, or whether that too is either a numerical artifact, or at least an artifact of doing a simulation in a box, where you have a finite cutoff to the left. Oh no, sorry, right there you have the left has to do with this potential deviation here, but whether it's an artifact of the particular simulation setup, not an artifact of the numerics. And so the latter is really not clear, but one of the things we can now say is when we use either Smagorinsky viscosity or when we use Smagorinsky viscosity, we reproduce spot on this additional bump here. It's amazing. And moreover, there is a systematic and rather strong departure from k to the minus 5 thirds, which has a k to the minus 0.1 scaling. So the spectrum is steeper. It's not 5 thirds, which is 1.67, but it's more like 1.77. It's a rather strong departure from the original Kolmogorov spectrum. There's, of course, a correction to that, which is, can be fitted by Scheele-Beck, and Scheele-Beck would predict 0.03. So this one is strong compared to even Scheele-Beck. And we don't know whether this is realistic, but we do know that we reproduce exactly the same kind of departure as Smagorinsky. And now, to come back to the Biskamp issue, we even reproduce this correction correctly with Hacker viscosity.
Is that a formula fit, or is it just a line draw by eye, or what?
As we said in our paper, it's not a formula. It's a formula fit. It's not by line, by eye. Mm-hmm. So you can first of all calculate an effective dissipation rate number by integrating over the spectrum, so you know how much energy you dissipate. So that gives you the correct shift in the horizontal direction. In the vertical shift, you have to calculate, of course, the epsilon correctly, and again, this you get from integration of the spectrum. You can do these things correctly, also if you do hyperviscosity. And one of the things you need to take into account is the derivative formula of your scheme, which is in our order 6 order accurate. And that really plays a role. I mean, for hyper, of course, it's only second order. So you have to take the accurate numerical dissipation operator that you have. That really makes a difference, at least as far as this fit is concerned.
But if you're talking about the blue and orange curves, it would seem hard to determine this correction with any accuracy.
You mean the K?
Yeah. I mean, we have the numbers in our paper.
The red curve is so smooth, and the blue and red.
Okay, I think that's yet another issue which Oke brought up. And I mean, we calculate the spectra by integrating how many points, or just summing up. We calculate the sum of the energy in each mode within a certain shell. So, of course, if you have a discrete shell, you may, by chance, have an underrepresentation of points within the shell.
And so you could do that better, in other words.
We could perhaps have done better. We have still not actually looked at that, or suggested to look at that. We used the formula because that's what the turbulence community, at least the French communist turbulence community.
Not the Japanese.
Apparently not. Good point. Actually, he, of course, also has a jump.
Yeah, but the rest is.
Mm.
Maybe just smooth.
But no, don't give this feature.
But the fact, of course, that they're systematically in the same we suggest, of course.
First of all, I would guess from the feature that the inertial range of the actor viscosity around is steeper. There's no.
You mean that one's steeper?
Yeah. But anyway, it's probably within the noise. But do we know that the bottleneck effect is just a bump and not a dip followed by a bump? Because if it is a little bit followed by a bump, of course you're going to have an overcorrection of
yes, that. Yes, yes.
And we need the 8,000 cube to study that.
I mean, so in other words, you're saying it really does.
Because you see, in that very positive case, you get a deeper, mm-hmm. a higher bump, mm-hmm. but you also get a little bit more of a dip. And that's an indication that perhaps the bottleneck is both a dip and a bump, and then that's a reason for the minus 0.1.
But one of the things how you can get rid of this one at least is by doing the one-dimensional power spectrum, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you still get k to the minus 0.1, steeper than.
Yes, you probably yes you would, but you would lose the bottleneck.
How big is the error actually when you calculate your fit?
The error
in the power law.
Yes, this is something one could perhaps calculate. We, of course, calculate cost factor by averaging over time. And one could, in principle, calculate how much.
But even here, from the
for finite density of averaging.
Even from these wiggles, there should be a spread.
Yes, I think this is sort of the same question as why in cosmology you have a departure, I mean, why you have this strong quadrupole component, that's what it was. Where you can. Because it's static, it's the same thing at all times. It has to do with a finite number of, a very small number of points, of course, that you have
in
the space.
Is this incompressible?
All simulations are all compressible, but deeply compressible. Mach number approximately 10%.
But so you said the other feature where you can prove that the one-dimensional power spectrum shows that the correction is much larger than Shiller that for the second order.
No, we.
What about the structure function? Do you see that in the second order structure function that is steeper than Shiller that?
In the structure function, we see that the third structure function is has linear scaling, as you would expect.
Yeah, but the second order.
And the second one, second order, gives you.
I don't see how you can have a smooth curve. And there's such a huge correction there.
Right. Yeah.
It should be the same number.
Right. No, not necessarily.
No, because the function wouldn't know about the bottleneck. It wouldn't know about the dip before the bump.
Yes.
For example.
So I mean, we know that the two are not exactly equivalent. The reason, of course, has to do with that with the fact that we are talking about finite intervals in wave number space and also in real space. So the two are not equivalent.
So if you have an inertial range, you should get the value given the structure function, most likely not this one, right? But it's a guess. But.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with you, but the interpretation. More work, I think, would be needed. I mean, by the way, one of the things I should say, the interpretation of this correction by Peter Davidson from Cambridge is that this is actually something like an inverse bottleneck. If you look at his book, it's an inverse bottleneck resulting from the large scale. That's why he thinks it's an artifact of using a box simulation where you force too close to the interpretation range. So it's something which everybody will see in simulations as long as they're not going to a million cubed or something yet. But experiments, of course, have easily they don't have a they have a million cubed. They also have, of course, a one-dimensional spectrum only. And in order to see, for example, if you have a compensated spectrum, you see a bump in the three-dimensional spectrum, and you don't see the bump in the one-dimensional spectrum. And the question, of course, is why is that? And that was when Wolfgang Dobler was visiting us, and he immediately calculated away his through this, which allows you to calculate the three-dimensional spectrum and the one-dimensional spectrum. The three-dimensional spectrum is just the integral over shells of the Fourier transform of the velocity, whereas the one-dimensional spectrum is one where you have just the Fourier transform in one direction, and you average over the other two directions. Now, by Parseval's relation, you can relate the xy integration to integration in perpendicular wave number space. And this integration you can turn again into a three-dimensional integration, where you would start your integration only from kz onwards. So this is a straightforward translation then, corresponding to an integral transform such that the one-dimensional spectrum can be expressed as a three-dimensional spectrum divided by k times dk. Now, if you have a power law for this, you divide by k, integrate over k, nothing will happen. Power law stays a power law. But, of course, near the dissipation range, you are departing from power laws. And also near the integral scale, you are departing from power laws. And that's where these two spectra are no longer the same. And in fact, you can demonstrate, as we did in our paper, that if you have a bump here, you will either have a much weaker bump here or just no bump. So this means you could still, and actually can still have in one-dimensional spectra a bump, but it's very much weaker than in 3D, and certainly not as prominent. And that it's actually there in wind tunnel turbulence is actually known. It has been, of course, called the bottleneck effect.
Pitts
by Jackson, and also Shea and Jackson in 93 already. Shea and Jackson did fits for wind tunnel turbulence, where they had a composite spectrum of K2 minus 5 thirds together with a minus 1 scaling at large wave numbers.
Maybe there was no bottleneck.
Yes, there was. It's a weak bottleneck effect already in one-dimensional spectra.
But there must be 3D probes in...
Oh, but only very few points, of course. You never have points in your... to do a full three-dimensional power spectrum sampling. You begin to do this now, of course, gradually. But the best I heard, I mean, a few years ago, the best one had was 32 squared, maybe, in array probes.
Well, you don't use probes.
Yeah, but that's what you would need to do in order to do a three-dimensional power spectrum. I should really stop here, but one thing which I think is really striking is the difference between, because people often don't understand what it means, helical turbulence versus non-helical. So helical turbulence in the decaying turbulence simulation really means that the bump is of magnetic energy is traveling to the left. So that's really what means inverse cascade. You really have an increase of energy at large wave numbers. Not just a decrease. I mean, if you have non-helical turbulence, you have a decrease of energy at the large wave numbers because you're killing off the small wave, small scales first, and that means the peak, of course, traveling to the left. But in an inverse cascade, really means the energy is generally increasing at large scales. It's an increase at the large scale. So therefore, it corresponds to a transfer from small scales to large scales in fully helical turbulence. So that was then the last thing I wanted to demonstrate in this picture so far.